From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a heel. You're as cuddly as a cactus. You're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black peel.
It's Friday night, and we are celebrating 100 years of Dr. Seuss, beloved children's book author who turned the world of children's books upside down with mischief and imagination. Before The Grinch was an animated Hollywood feature or a Jim Carrey live-action movie, he was born in the imagination of Theodore Seuss Geisel, universally known by his pen name Dr. Seuss. Along with the Cat in the Hat and the Lorax and the Sneetches and Horton and Yertle the Turtle and so many more, Seuss's Grinch stole the hearts of children and parents across America and around the world. With a keen ear for rhyme and a zany, perfectionist's approach to cartooning, Theodore Geisel revolutionized children's literature, establishing Dr. Seuss as a household name in his time and in ours. His storytelling is cheerful anarchy, his artwork delightfully absurd, his prose hopped on pop in 1962, and it still hops today. His work was deceptively simple and overwhelmingly good, as in full of giddy goodness. Theodore Geisel was born March 2, 1904. His life was not perhaps what you might expect, but his legacy is everything that you would. Tonight on Point, a celebration of everything Seuss at 100 years and counting.
You're a rotter, Mr. Grinch. You're the king of sinful thoughts.
Joining me now from Amherst, Massachusetts, is Charles Cohen, one of the world's foremost collectors of all things Seuss and author of the new book, The Seuss, The Whole Seuss, and Nothing But the Seuss, a visual biography of Theodore Seuss Geisel. Good evening and welcome, Charles Cohen.
Good evening to you, Tom.
It's great to have you with us. Also with me in the studio is Peggy Sharon, founder of Action for Children's Television and a longtime advocate for the hearts and minds of children. Peggy, wonderful to have you here.
Nice to be here.
So here we are, and what a treat to get to look back on this amazing body of work that has shaped the imaginations of so many children in so many places. Charles Cohen, it's a terrific book you've got, full of Seussiana or Seussania, things I'd never seen before. Peggy Sharon, you've watched children respond to all kinds of stimulation for many years. There's a lot we want to dive into, but first, Dr. Seuss, what do you make of this great mythic icon, his impact, his profile in the world of children?
I think the best thing that has happened about his birthday is that this past week, the New York Times had one of their local daily crossword puzzles where the whole thing was about Dr. Seuss, which made it very easy for me to finish, by the way.
I'm sure it did.
I think that my favorite part of Dr. Seuss is that he changed the world of Dick and Jane books to teach you how to read.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, reading books in kindergarten, first grade, before he came out with his Cat in the Hat.
And I remember them all, Dick and Jane, the perfectly pressed little dolls ran about in perfect gardens, but no real fun in this reading.
Right. The good news is most American children, at least, didn't look like Dick and Jane and didn't act like Dick and Jane. And I think a lot of parents were afraid they would start to act like the Cat in the Hat, who was sort of a bit of an anarchist also.
Yes, he was. Charles Cohen, when Dr. Seuss first came on the scene, in a big way, he had a long windup, and we're going to get to that. His background is fascinating. But when he first really hit the stage in the late 50s, what was his reception? Was this seen as a welcome alternative to Dick and Jane or an outburst of anarchy and madness?
I think a little bit of both. I think that as has been pointed out by Peggy, the sickly sweet people that were represented by Dick and Jane were really not normal children. And there were people who could see Ted's new things and say, geez, this is the way kids should be. They should have a little bit of fun. They are a little bit playful. But there is a majority of the people who were really concerned that this isn't what we should be teaching kids in our school. They were worried, as she pointed out, that the Cat in the Hat was a little bit wild, as were Thing 1 and Thing 2, of course. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just here in the United States. There was a big problem trying to get it published over in Great Britain. They thought that this was just a terrible thing and probably pretty much typically American.
But as a tool for learning to read, not to mention stimulating young minds, just as a tool for reading, it was great.
Yes.
Oh, it was.
Go ahead.
And why did it work so well? Charles?
For me, I think that there are three things that that contribute to Ted Geisel being, or Dr. Seuss being, the legend that he is now. First, you have this identifiable style of illustration. He's got his own adjective now, right? Think people look at a wild beast and they say, oh, that looks Seussian.
Oh, yeah.
And then in addition to that, you have this equally recognizable sound to his language. There's a certain lilt to his particular rhythm, the way that he rhymes. It was not a simple thing. You mentioned in the introduction that it was deceptively simple. I mean, he could work all year to get a 20-page book out just to make sure that those rhymes sounded right. And trust me, I've been to innumerable things where politicians try to do the same thing.
Heaven help us.
Oh, Lord, they're all terrible. But in addition, you've got those two things. But then beyond that, he's got these messages that he's trying to impart. Messages, for example, about tolerance, that it doesn't matter if you have a star on your belly or not, that a person's a person no matter how small. And if you try to tell a child normally about an issue like tolerance, it's going to sound like a sermon. But if you do it with his particular style of language and his illustrations, they're willing to listen to it. And that, to me, is what's so amazing.
Let's listen to a little bit of that sound that delivered the messages and the imagination. This from the 1965 Fox in Socks.
Fox, socks. Fox, knocks. Knocks in box. Fox in socks. Knocks on fox in socks, in box. Socks on knocks, and knocks in box. Fox in socks, on box, on knocks. Chicks with bricks come, chicks with blocks come. Chicks with bricks and blocks and clocks come.
Look, sir, Mr. Knox.
Okay, Fox on Socks, 1965. Peggy, oh my gosh, this takes me back to long nights reading Dr. Seuss. At a certain point, I thought I'd go mad, and yet the kids just ate it up and ate it up. It sounds nuts, but it's so effective.
I think the parents ate it up, too. You couldn't help but smile while you hear it or while you say it. And it's amazing to take those very short words, for most of them they were very short words, and get such a delightful rhythm and story going. You know, with Cat in the Hat, he was directed to use less than 220 words, 250 words, and he turned it into a story that every child knows now, with bedtime story, really.
But based on that simple challenge,
right.
Give me an entire story with just a couple of hundred words.
And then Bennett Cerf came to him and said, try to do it with 50. And they made a bet. And the fact is, that's how Green Eggs and Ham grew. And, you know, I do not like Green Eggs and Ham. I do not like them, Sam, I am. I will not eat them in a box. I will not eat them with a fox. It's just fun to say that out loud.
That is his best-selling book of all time.
Green Eggs and Ham, of course.
And I mean, so here's this whole story with this great point about trying things,
right.
Trying things that you wouldn't necessarily like, all done with 50 words, and that's the best-selling book of his of all
time.
Isn't
that amazing?
And to be Dr. Seuss's best-selling book is no mean feat. He had 44 books translated into 21 languages. They've sold more than 500 million copies. To be the best of all that, Charles Cohen, what was in these challenges? Why was Ted Geisel being asked to write books of 200 words, of 50 words?
Behind that lay this evil thing called the word list.
Right.
At least that's the way that Ted saw it. And what it was that educators had the belief that the kids could only understand a certain number of words at a particular age. And Ted has a great article that he wrote against word lists where he tries to explain why it shouldn't be any different if the words are coming in through their ears or through their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
He was painfully aware that he as a writer was competing with television, with comic books, and the kids were, through those other sources, learning a lot more than their ancestors had at the same age, and that it was silly to think that they only could learn this number of words. He also had a very interesting incident in 1949. He was giving a lecture out in Utah, and while he was there, a family drove him out to the Great Salt Lake. They had a small child who recited all of Thidwick the Big-Hearted Moose to Dr. Seuss, since he had him right there in the car.
Yeah.
And Dr. Seuss was really confounded by this. He said, how does he do that? I didn't write it for anyone of his age. It's meant for someone older than he. I don't understand how he could memorize it. And that was when he first began to realize the power of his own ability, that this infectious rhyming scheme that he has allows children to be able to memorize words even if they can't read them yet. And then once they have that down, they're driven to read these words. So that he ends up teaching them by using that and, as you had asked about these smaller and smaller numbers of words, to get kids of a younger and younger age to read. I mean, really, that's probably the biggest part of his legacy, although it seems so small given how much I adore this guy and his work. But to be able to change the face of literature, to be able to aim at children at a younger age, that was just remarkable.
I agree with that, and I think that his rhythm is part of what helps the kids and their parents memorize those verses.
You're absolutely carried along, syncopated and wild as it may be.
The rhythm to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street came from a transatlantic trip he made where he picked up that rhythm from the rhythm of the ship's engine. Mm-hmm. And to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street.
And off he went.
And it's a delicious celebration of imagination.
It's funny that this constraint of the word list, which, as Charles says, he rebelled against, may actually have made him, because it's that very constraint that maybe produced the genius of the Cat in the Hat, Hop on Pop, all the rest.
It made it easy to remember it.
Absolutely.
And memorize it. You know, when I knew I was going to come do this program, I thought, gee, I better renew my acquaintanceship with my kids are grown up now, and I haven't read them out loud in a long time.
Yeah.
And it just comes to you. You get the first line, and you remember the whole next six verses.
Yes, it's right there. Charles, Eric Gibson was writing in the Wall Street Journal how Ted Geisel, Dr. Seuss, pulled off this world of cheerful illogic and unreason that was still somehow plausible. And you know instantly what he means when he says that. What was the trick? How did these crazy stories so hold together? They seem so sensible, and yet they were so zany.
Well, I think you have to remember that you are talking about childhood, that childhood minds are the ones that these are aimed at. And child's minds go all over the place. There's a whole fantasy element to it. And I think that these beasts, which, by the way, came from other places, it wasn't that they were meant to be creative beasts for children. And they originally came from the days of Prohibition. And these were beasts of the delirium tremens when people were coming down from their alcohol high.
He had originally drawn them to represent that, you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, all through the late 20s and early 30s, mm-hmm. when he was doing his cartooning work, you see the exact same kinds of beasts, but the point of all the jokes was about
liquor. You get a bad hangover and you're seeing wild stuff.
Exactly, and he would send those characters out. There was a place called the Waiting Room at Dang Dang where the beast of the delirium tremens hung out, and if someone was drinking a certain type of liquor and had that type of hangover, they'd send the camel with the sweater on it or something.
And a whole story there because, of course, his father was originally a brewer.
I was going to say that.
And we'll come to that. We've got a break coming up. I want to come back and really look at his biography. But Peggy, Charon, you look a lot at visual entertainment and education for children. In recent years, a lot of Dr. Seuss has gone to the screen. Do you like that work?
Some I like and some I don't seem to like at all. And maybe it's not fair not to like the new movie because I haven't seen it, because I didn't go see it because I didn't like any of the stuff that was promoting it. I didn't like the face of the Cat in the Hat. And I find that if I see something that takes off on a book and I don't think it's well done, it's a negative for me. So I just stay away.
That kind of sassy, snarly, right. A little bit mean Mike Myers representation of it.
It's hard to do it right. And it's a question of how the animation is done and the attitude of the people who are putting it together.
We're going to learn a lot more about the man behind Dr. Seuss. We've got to take a short break. We'll be back with more of his legacy, the legacy of beloved children's book author Theodore Geisel, better known as Dr. Seuss, on the week of the 100th anniversary of his birth. Let's go into the break listening to an excerpt from the Seuss classic, Green Eggs and Ham, narrated by Marvin Miller. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
You do not like green eggs and ham?
I do not like them, Sam, I am.
Would you, with a goat?
I would not, could not, with a goat.
Could you, on a boat?
I could not, would not, on a boat. I will not, with a goat. I will not eat them in the rain. I will not eat them on a train. Not in the dark. Not in a tree. Not in a car. You let me be. I do not like them in a box. I do not like them with a fox. I will not eat them in a house. I do not like them with a mouse. I do not like them here or there. I do not like them anywhere.
I do not like green eggs and ham!
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the life and legacy of Dr. Seuss on the 100th anniversary of his birth, about his children's books, his politics, his life. Here's an excerpt from The Sneetches, narrated by Marvin Miller.
Now, the star-belly Sneetches had bellies with stars. The plain-belly Sneetches had none upon theirs. Those stars weren't so big. They were really so small, you might think such a thing wouldn't matter at all. But because they had stars, all the star-belly Sneetches would brag,
"We're the best kind of Sneetch on the beaches."
With their snoots in the air, they would sniff and they'd snort,
"We'll have nothing to do with the plain-belly sort."
And whenever they met some, when they were out walking, they'd hike right on past them without even talking. When the star-belly children went out to play ball, could a plain belly get in the game? Not at all. You only could play if your bellies had stars, and the plain belly children had none upon bars. When the star-belly Sneetches had Frankfurter roasts, or picnics, or parties, or marshmallow toasts, they never invited the plain belly Sneetches. They left them out cold in the dark of the beaches. They kept them away, never let them come near. And that's how they treated them, year after year.
The Sneetches, from Dr. Seuss, one of 40-some books that have sold 500 million copies around the world and changed the way children learn to read, maybe the way children see the world. We're joined tonight by Charles Cohen. He joins us from Amherst, Massachusetts. He's author of The Seuss, The Whole Seuss, and Nothing But the Seuss, a visual biography of Theodore Seuss Geisel, that is, Dr. Seuss. And with me in the studio, Peggy Charon, founder of Action for Children's Television. Charles Cohen, I want to get a bit more of the biography out on the table here. There's the famous moment that everybody knows. If you begin to read about Dr. Seuss, 1937, and he's trudging around New York City with his manuscript under his arm. He's been to 26 different or 27 different publishers. They've all said it's too weird, it's too different. He finally bumps into an old friend from Dartmouth College who takes it and, well, he's off to the races with "And to Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street." But take us back to this man's earlier life in a nutshell. Who was he?
Well, I think people may not know that for the first decade before that incident took place, he was a cartoonist and an advertising man. He made his existence, his career, by doing over 1,000 different cartoons in the late 20s and early 30s in various periodicals. And they became so popular that he was asked to do a lot of advertising. And he did advertisements for everything from beer to ball bearings, fans, furnaces, rifles, radios, sugar, scotch, you name it.
So he had a lot of experience as an illustrator and cartoonist. What were his formative experiences, even earlier? His father, we heard, was a brewer, but then later a zookeeper, which makes a lot of sense.
That's what I thought was the most important thing
zookeeper.
His father did.
Where was that? How did that happen, Charles?
Well, this is one of the things I try to correct in my book. A lot of people are attributing things that weren't necessarily the case to being influenced on him. His father didn't actually become the superintendent of the park that contained the zoo until Ted was already graduated from college and living in New York. He did live near the zoo.
This is in Springfield, Massachusetts, central Massachusetts, a factory town.
Yes, exactly. And his whole family were brewers, his grandfather and his father. So, his father became president of the brewery in which he had been working a week before Prohibition started. So they effectively put them out of business with Prohibition.
Poor timing. They were also a German immigrant family, which was difficult when the United States went to war with Germany.
Yes, in World War I, Ted was going to school, and he did have fun poked at him as being a child of German descent during World War I, although, again, people have made more of that in terms of people seem to think there's a direct link between his experiencing prejudice and then going on to be the person who helped a whole generation of children grow, or many generations of children grow up not tolerating prejudice. But, in fact, there is a whole area in between in which he participated in the same prejudices.
What do you mean by that?
There was the style of humor in the late 20s and early 30s was to make fun of everybody. Mm-hmm. That included women, Jews, Scotch people, whether they be African-American or African tribesmen. And he played part of that. He made fun of everybody.
In ways that would not be PC today.
Not even close. Mm-hmm. He did tend to have a slightly different view. He tended to look into more social situations, why a particular group might have a large family or dress really well. But, you know, some of the things are indefensible. There are pictures of African Americans with very simian features, for example. Mm-hmm. But it's very heroic for him to have overcome what were the prejudices of his time in order to not just personally not do that anymore, but to go out and expound that nobody should be doing this. And he did this well ahead of the curve. He did this before the Brown v. Education decision. Mm-hmm.
There was this remarkable moment, and I don't know quite what to make of it, how it factors in, but his interaction with Teddy Roosevelt as a boy.
Yes. Well, when he was younger, he was supposed to be up on stage receiving an award from Teddy Roosevelt, along with a bunch of other folks, for collecting
selling Liberty Bonds, which might have been particularly important to the child of German immigrants who wanted to prove he was an American.
Exactly. And the story goes that when they got down the line, he was the last one and they'd run out of medals. So he was alone on the stage with Teddy Roosevelt staring imperiously at him and saying, "What's this child doing here?"
And he was whisked away and ever after, or at least for many years, had no interest in public appearances.
Again, not true.
boy, the legends grow thick and furious here. Set us straight, Charles.
Well, it is true that later in life he was very shy and did not like to go in front of the cameras. But prior to that incident, of course, he had been performing in all manner of ways. He was in a debate club. He played the banjo. He did all kinds of things like that. And after that, he continued doing the same kinds of things. In fact, in college, he continued to do things like that. Even into the 30s, when he was promoting Esso Marine products for Standard Oil, he would get up and give a whole speech that was half comedy and half sales pitch for them. So if he was truly ashamed or afraid of performing, he wouldn't have been able to do those. It wasn't really in those contexts. I think he was most afraid when he had to defend himself, had to talk about himself and his work. That's when he became uncomfortable. And then later in life, he truly was. You can see just a few pieces of footage of him on To Tell the Truth in 1958 or on the Omnibus Theater program in 1956. But it's you'd be hard-pressed to find him on camera.
Peggy Charon, Charles Cohen usefully reminds us that this was an artist who, you know, came into his own in the 20s with all kinds of images that would be way out of bounds today. And yet he grew up politically to stand for a lot of very progressive views of the world. That is quite an evolution.
It is. And The Lorax is one of my favorite books because of the message and because of the way it's put together. You know, the color and gray, black and whitish.
This is 1971, all about the environment.
Right. And it's the elected officials who think that trees pollute. I forget who it was who said that, which was a creepy thing to say. He wrote this book about truffulas. Truffulas grow on trees. And the big businessman, the stand-in for the big businessman, who says, "Business is business, and business must grow, regardless of crummies and tummies, you know." Crummies and tummies were what the kids were left with when the trees all went. And the feeling of the book is very much like the movie Metropolis, which is one of my favorite old movies that makes a point about big corporations. And you feel it in this book. And I love what the other character says to the lead about what's happening to the ponds. "You're galumping the pond where the humming fish hummed. No more can they hum, for their gills are all gummed. So I'm sending them off. Oh, their future is dreary. They'll walk on their fins and get woefully weary in search of some water that isn't so smeary." I mean, we're still having that problem today.
In 1971, he was right on top of it there. We've got a bit more tape from The Lorax from 71. Let's listen.
"Ah, just enough to finish the cuffs. A thing of beauty is a joy forever. Now, who'd you say you were, little fella?"
"Mister, I am the Lorax. I speak for the trees. I speak for the trees, for the trees have no tongues. And I'm asking you, sir, at the top of my lungs, that thing, that horrible thing that I see, what's that thing you've made out of my truffula tree?"
"Look, Lorax, calm down. There's no cause for alarm. I chopped down just one tree. I'm doing no harm. This thing is most useful. This thing is a need, a fine something that all people need. It's a shirt. It's a sock. It's a glove. It's a hat.
But it has other uses. Yes, far beyond that. You can use it for carpets, for pillows, for sheets, or curtains, or covers for bicycle seats.
Sir, you're crazy. You're crazy with greed. Well, there's no one on earth who would buy that fool's need.
1971, the Lorax, and there the Onceler and the Lorax argue about whether or not the tree should be cut down to make Thneeds. Here was an evolution. I want to turn to San Diego, California for a moment, where we're joined by Judith Morgan. She's a longtime friend of the Geisel family since 1964. She's author with her husband, Neil Morgan, of the authorized biography of Theodore Geisel, Dr. Seuss and Mr. Geisel. Welcome, Judith Morgan.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to be here.
It's wonderful to have you with us. Judith Morgan, you knew Ted Geisel in the years when he was moving toward a more political theme and tone in his work. Was he very upfront about that? Was he very self-aware that he wanted to become more political?
I don't know how far in advance he figured it out, but once he had the idea of the Lorax, he overrode all opposition, including lack of warm reception from his publisher, Random House, because he believed in it. And it didn't sell very well, but he felt good about that, and I really believe that at that point he became aware that he could make a difference in a different kind of way, not just helping children learn to read or expand imagination, but take those extra steps.
Judith Morgan, Ted Geisel had moved to La Jolla, California, near San Diego there, I think in 1948, with his first wife, Helen. You got to know him in the 60s. Describe him for us personally. What kind of man was Dr. Seuss?
He always said he really looked more like a Dartmouth professor. He was tall and lean and shy. And frankly, he looked like some of the creatures he drew. He seemed to have one eyebrow up a whole lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Quizzical expressions. He was most happy at work, and he was least happy in social situations, except small dinner parties at his home. And then, as Charles was saying earlier, the old performance came out, and he would sing with friends who were playing the piano and not sing well, but he sang.
Their house was on the beach overlooking the Pacific, and I picture the big windows of his studio with the desk facing the other day. What were his work habits, Judith Morgan?
Well, his first home was down by the beach, but for the 50 years he lived on the highest point in La Jolla, called Mount Soledad, and that's where he really put his back to the windows and focused on what he was doing. And yet he loved that space. He absolutely had to have it. He ended up buying property around so that when he looked out, it was ocean or hills or sky. But he would work long hours, never very early in the morning. He was a late-night person. Sometimes he would say midnight is the best time for him. Mm-hmm.
Charles Cohen, Ted Geisel's first wife, Helen, we read in Kathleen Kroll's biography, was important in encouraging him to go with his illustration. Is that right? What was the story of Helen, his first wife?
Well, actually, she was incredibly important. She was the person who noticed him doodling rather than paying as much attention as perhaps he should have been when they were together over in England in school. She finished her degree. He did not. But she encouraged him to go into the cartooning in the first place. But it was through her life. She really was everything to him while she was alive. I mean, she was the confidant. She was the person he trusted most, or perhaps the only person he trusted in doing the editing and giving advice about his own work. He was very bad with finances, from what I understand, and she really was in charge of all of that. So she was incredibly important. However, as you will learn if you read Judith and Neil's book, she had, I believe it was Guillain-Barré syndrome, which was really very difficult for her and, of course, difficult on Ted.
Judith, can you describe what is Guillain-Barré syndrome?
It involved a very sudden paralysis that actually came on at a dinner party, and she ended up in an iron lung, absolutely unable to move for months.
And how did she ultimately die?
She committed suicide in 1967.
Pretty traumatic for everyone there. Charles Cohen, how did that whole personal saga show itself in his work, if it did?
Well, that was a very bad year for him all around. Not only did you have Helen's suicide, but you also had his father dying within a year's period. And on top of that, he was involved in a major lawsuit. Pointer Industries had produced some figures based on illustrations that he had done in 1932 for Liberty Magazine and hadn't asked his permission. And Ted was involved for most of the year in litigation about that, ultimately losing it and changing his whole perspective on the marketing of his own material, since people were apparently able to do it even without his permission in some cases. So all around, it was a bad time for him. It showed up more, I think, in the personal things. If you look at some of the artwork he did during that time that he kept around his house, you can see him alluding to those subjects, but it didn't. He kept it pretty much out of his work. You can see in the dedication of various books then right thereafter that he was tending to dedicate them more to Audrey, to her daughters Lark and Lee, for example. But you don't really see a big downturn, I don't think, in his mood about it in the books. Mm.
Judith Morgan, here we are at the 100th anniversary of his birth, and more than a decade since he died in 1991 at age 87. If Ted Geisel were around today, what do you think he'd be drawing and writing and saying?
That's interesting. I would imagine that it would, as it did then, either relate to the headlines or be just a little bit ahead of them. He was a political animal, and he would probably be pursuing environmental matters. Probably from living in La Jolla, he would be involved with some of the oceanographic studies and environmental problems that are going on. He had good friends at University of California, San Diego, and kept up with their work. And I imagine he could have left in those directions. I feel very strongly he would not be doing movies or any of the other things. I do believe he would have stayed with the writing. He never tired of it.
He never tired of the writing or the drawing all the way to the end, Judith?
Absolutely. I mean, he fussed about it, of course, but he never found anything else that he would rather be doing. He said that, and I think only because of his severe health problems at the end did he allow himself to turn to, oh, the places you'll go and you're only old once, and really face that part of life.
Look straight at it. Judith Morgan, it's been great having you for a few minutes tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Judith Morgan, a longtime friend of the Geisel family and Ted Geisel, Dr. Seuss. She is the co-author of Dr. Seuss and Mr. Geisel, the authorized biography. We'll continue our conversation about Dr. Seuss after a short break. Let's go into it listening to a song from the animated adaptation of Dr. Seuss's The Lorax. I'm Tom Ashbrook. More in a minute. This is On Point.
The old assembly line comes another flea, answering humanity's each and every need. Everybody do 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 need a flea.
It isn't just a panty vest.
You should wear a hammock when you need rest.
It's a toothbrush holder for your weekend guest.
Your canary will love it. It's a lovely nest.
Try it in soup. It adds great zest.
It'll cure those backache pains in your chest. Everybody do do.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the life and legacy of Theodore Geisel, or as he is known by children and adults everywhere, Dr. Seuss. Let's listen to a bit of Yertl the Turtle, narrated again by Marvin Miller.
I'm Yertl the Turtle. Oh, marvelous me, for I am the ruler of all that I see.
Then again, from below, in the great heavy stack, came a groan from that plain little turtle named Mac.
Your Majesty, please. I don't like to complain, but down here below we are feeling great pain. I know up there on top you are seeing great sights, but down here at the bottom we too should have rights.
Yertle the Turtle from 1958, read there by Marvin Miller. Charles Cohen, the 1957, 1958 were huge years for Ted Geisel. How the Grinch Stole Christmas, The Cat in the Hat, and then this. How did this big breakout suddenly come?
Well, when you invent two of the most famous characters of all time in children's literature in a single year, that pretty much constitutes a breakout.
But he'd been writing for a long time without hitting that level of success. What was it that just pole vaulted him up there? Did he have some conscious breakthrough in the way he did his work? Was it just good fortune that he hit on these formulas?
I believe it really was just good fortune. It wasn't a conscious effort, as far as I can tell. I mean, he had been creating wonderful characters like Horton prior to this, and he had already been working towards this type of character, this type of rhyme scheme. He'd been doing all these things previously.
But he was well into his life. Mulberry Street was 37, 500 Hats of Bartholomew Cobbins, 38. Cobbins, 38. Horton hatches the egg, 1940. McGilligan's Pool, 47. He was not a newcomer to this at all.
No, I point out in my book that in his working career, which I can judge basically from the time that he became the editor-in-chief of his magazine in college through the last book he published, that this marks almost the exact midpoint in his career.
And it's the moment that everybody soon knew about Dr. Seuss, Piggy Chair.
I think the advertising industry knew about him earlier because he wrote and invented the campaign for Quick Henry the Flit.
Flit was a what insect?
It was a bug
repellent?
Insecticide, mm-hmm. That was as famous in its time as any, you know, Just Do It or any few words selling a product in this time.
He was so far in, and with this name, Dr. Seuss. Now, you're our legend buster tonight, Charles Cohn, setting us straight on so many fronts. Now, the understanding that's come down through the mist of time to me here is that he used his mother's maiden name, his middle name, Seuss, because he was hoping to preserve his name, Theodore Geisel, for serious works. And because his mother had wanted him to be a doctor, he tacked that on. Does that make sense? Does that add up?
Parts of it, yes. Seuss was his mother's maiden name and his middle name, and he was theoretically saving his real name for the great American novel that he hoped to write and never quite got around to. There are some problems with the doctor was basically added just to jack up the name a little bit, mm-hmm. Much like the character in A Thousand Clowns adds a doctor to his name to jack it up a little bit, as he says. But there are inaccuracies about that, too. The original story that was told about how he began using the name was that there was a drinking incident, a gin party of the drinking kind, not the game-playing kind.
And where was this, in college days at Dartmouth?
This was in college days, yeah, during Prohibition. Mm-hmm. And he was caught along with a bunch of people and was booted from the editorship of the Dartmouth Jack-O-Lantern. And the story that has been told in the past was that in order to continue to publish, even though he'd been kicked out, that he started using Seuss as a pseudonym to be able to publish. What really had happened was that he became the editor-in-chief and started using pseudonyms of all sorts, from Florence Nightingale, Louis Pasteur, okay. I mean, even more extraneous ones. And I think it was mostly to distance, so it didn't seem like he was publishing everything of his own. So even that story has a little bit of
falsehood. So the record says straight. Peggy Charon, Kathleen Kroll writes of Ted Geisel and his work, Dr. Seuss, that it was always respectful toward children, though not always respectful toward authority, the rule makers. He was subversive in that way.
He was, and that's really my favorite part of him. You talk about serious. He wanted to be serious later. I think that he picked up on his ability to make a point about a political problem. When he did The Lorax, the lumber industry, the Wood Flooring Manufacturers Association, was so worried about what he was saying about logging too much that they actually did a film that was the Truax, which was the other side of
they not felt a film, they had to maybe, respond
yes,
to the Lorax.
And he wanted it to be used in schools so the kids would get his sense of what was important.
And there was the Butter Battle
the
book.
The Butter
well.
Battle book is wonderful. It's the Ukes and the Zooks.
And this is anti-nukes.
Right. And the battle was about whether you should butter your bread on the upside or the downside. And there were two sides, and the battles kept getting bigger and bigger, and the weapons got bigger, and the threats got bigger. You can't read it without thinking of weapons of mass destruction now. And you end the book waiting to see what happens.
50 years earlier, he was doing political work. This is what people seem to think, that he became politicized around the time of the Lorax. But actually, Ted Geisel, under the name Dr. Seuss, and also even prior to that under the name Ted with two D's, was drawing political cartoons that were being published in newspapers back in the 30s and then into the 40s. So if something bothered him, whether it be the economy or the need to join World War II or discrimination, he was involved already with politics, and then bringing that aspect of his personality into his children's books, to me, was just a matter of time.
Charles Cohn, we've just got a minute left. What do you make of the way Dr. Seuss has come to film?
I always ask people, what color is the Grinch? And virtually everyone responds with green. Mm. But, of course, back in 1957, when Ted drew him, he wasn't. He was black and white with pink eyes, a red hat, and a red coat. We think of him as green because in 1966, Chuck Jones did that wonderful thing that you opened our show with. So we know that it really isn't whether people are able to tinker with Dr. Seuss or not. It's the quality, which is exactly what Peggy was saying, the quality of the product. The Grinch is a great example because in 1977, Gerard Baldwin did a third version in something called Halloween as Grinch Night. It won an Emmy. In 1982, Bill Perez did another version of The Grinch, a fourth one, in something called The Grinch Grinches the Cat in the Hat. It won an Emmy. I don't have a problem with the attempt. It's a question of whether they do it well or not. If they do it poorly, that's the problem.
Well, let's just hope that Dr. Seuss always boils down to a child in the lap of an adult hearing a story read and a wonderful story read. Charles Cohen, it's been wonderful having you with us. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. This is so much fun to talk about, Ted.
Charles Cohen, the author of The Seuss, The Whole Seuss, and Nothing But The Seuss, and Peggy Chern. It's always just great to have you. Thanks so much for coming in.
I loved it. I learned more than I learned from the crossword puzzle I did.
Great. Peggy Chern, founder of Action for Children's Television. Let's close this hour with the Seuss classic, The Cat in the Hat. To find out more about Dr. Seuss and the life of Theodore Geisel, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
When you've mislaid a certain something, keep your cool and don't get hot. Calculatus Eliminatus is the best friend that you've got. Calculatus Eliminatus always helps an awful lot. The way to find a missing something is to find out where it's not. It isn't here. I'll mark this X. It isn't there. I'll mark that Y. It isn't underneath the apple. Mark the apple, HKI.
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you to voters from coast to coast who have truly made this a super Tuesday.
John Kerry has what it takes right here to be President of the United States, and I, for one, intend to do everything in my power to make him the next President of the United States.
What sees us through tough times? Freedom, faith, families, and sacrifice. President Bush, steady leadership in times of change.
We're just not going to let him put his arm around a firefighter on top of that horrible pile. We're not going to let him use our images to promote a candidacy which is hypocritical.
Martha Stewart has been found guilty on all four counts that she was charged with. She was charged with conspiracy, with making false statements to federal agents, with obstruction of justice, and she has been found guilty in connection with her sale of ImClone stock in 2001.
A series of coordinated blasts struck major Shiite Muslim shrines both in Baghdad and in Karbala as thousands of pilgrims converged for the final day of a major religious festival.
What we are seeing now in Iraq today, specifically, obviously, is an attempt to use terror to disrupt and interfere with our plan to turn over sovereignty to the Iraqis later this summer.
More than 95% of the items of the law is agreed upon. The remaining is very small.
The Oregon Constitution prohibits the county from discriminating against same-sex couples when they are applying for marriage licenses.
Shareholders have waited too long and have spoken too clearly. Michael Eisner must leave now.
And there's a week. John Kerry wins 9 of 10 Super Tuesday primary contests, effectively winning the Democratic presidential nomination with John Edwards' withdrawal on Wednesday. President Bush unveils his first re-election campaign commercials, but some family members of 9/11 victims criticize the president for using images from Ground Zero in the ads. Martha Stewart is found guilty of conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and two counts of making false statements. Bombings at Shiite Muslim shrines in Baghdad and Karbala kill 181. Last-minute objections stall the signing of Iraq's interim constitution today. Portland, Oregon becomes the latest city to issue same-sex marriage licenses, and unrest at the Walt Disney Company as 43% of shareholders vote to oppose CEO Michael Eisner's re-election to the company's board. And there's a week. And, Jack, so much going on, but the most consequential thing going on just today in Baghdad, this interim constitution, which is supposed to drive everything forward toward a handover of sovereignty, has not gone forward.
No, it hasn't. And the NPR reporter had the, the band was ready to play. The gold pens had been passed out. A severe embarrassment. Now, whether this is just a temporary, hiccup or not, we don't know. But it does sort of set up the stark issue here, which is democracy, majority rule, that's what the Shiites want, versus national cohesion or stability.
You mean the Iraqis may not vote for what George Bush or the United States wants?
That's right. That's right. And what the Shiites want, which is to say they don't want to let the Kurds have veto power on the Constitution. And they say, why not? Because we're the majority. Mm-hmm. But in order to maintain an integral state, they're going to have to accept a compromise like that. The Bush administration says we want democracy. But is that really what we want, or do we want national cohesion?
National cohesion so that things can settle down and the pipelines get rebuilt and the oil flows again.
Keep that oil flowing. I mean, just on sheer realpolitik grounds, we want a stable Iraq more than anything. And if the Kurds, they have already talked about a very generous form of autonomy. If they continue down that line, the Turks aren't going to like this one bit.
Paul Bremer reported absolutely livid today. Can you imagine the pressure on this man, Jack?
Oh, boy, this was his moment, and it just didn't, the trigger didn't get pulled, although apparently there were some triggers being pulled. There was some fear that there'd be a shelling of the ceremony. So bad is the security situation. And, that continues to haunt everything. I mean, right from the first days, people were saying we didn't have enough people in Iraq to essentially perform some shock and awe on those who would break order. And we still don't. And order is not there, and that's driving everybody toward what? Forming their own militias. So, and that way could lie civil war.
So don't leave the orchestra sitting exposed too long. Meanwhile, at home, a still divided country.
A still divided country. And here's the playing field as we get going. This is Stan Greenberg from his book, The Two Americas. He's got 189 electoral votes in the red states. This is the states that consistently are going to be with the Republicans. 179 electoral votes in the blue states, the Democrats, and 170 in the battleground states. And if you go to those battleground states and say, which party do you belong to? 46% say the Democrats, 46% say the Republicans. This is parity. And the question is, can anything break this up for this election?
You can't balance the scales much tighter than that.
It can't be. And, one hypothesis, Nelson Polsby, the political scientist at Berkeley, says presidential elections turn on Democratic turnout. That is, if the Democrats can get their vote to vote for them, they can win. If the Democrats come to the poll but vote for someone else, as they did for Ronald Reagan, they lose. That's one theory. The other theory is that what could break it is one from an old-time political scientist called E.E. Schatzschneider, who says the substitution of conflicts is the most devastating kind of political strategy. That is, to break a deadlock, say politics is about something else. You thought it was about this. It's really about this. And the 46% say, you're right. And it grows, and that breaks the deadlock, and you have realignment. The question is, will there be any such bold political strategy this year?
Gay marriage is up on the rails and ready to go if somebody wants to use it that way. It looks like it may be in use already.
It could be. On the other hand, for the Democrats, it could be trade. Who knows?
It is going to be wild to watch everything starting to come out this week with John Kerry and his victory moment, George Bush putting his big ads out on the air, a whole lot to come. Jack, we'll be watching. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.